Hipsters, gather around and listen up here. For the next half hour, you're going to learn about Fluxus, and not just from me, but from the mouth of one of its original founders. That's Fluxus, spelled F-L-U-X-U-S. If you've never heard of Fluxus before, then God have mercy on your hipster soul, because Fluxus was the coolest thing to happen in the 20th century, and maybe even the 21st. Fluxus was certainly cooler and wilder than punk rock, maybe even cooler than rock and roll. Who says so? Me, Alan Bukoff. I'm probably the coolest person you've never met. Just take my word for that. Fluxus changed the world so much that it's hard now to appreciate the effect it had. And even though it completely changed the world, changed the trajectory the world was on, it, Fluxus, is still little known or little understood. I know, doesn't make sense, but it's true. Okay, so what is Fluxus? Fluxus is one of the names for a band of people, many of them avant-garde artists, who started doing a lot of very interesting, different, and weird stuff in the early 1960s. Now many people who talk about Fluxus describe it as an art movement or as something that happened in art. It's actually much bigger and more interesting than that. Fluxus was this gigantic release of creative energy or creative potential in human culture, civilized human culture. That's culture spelled with a small c. Culture is a good thing, and it gives meaning and context to all of our lives. It's the water we swim in. It keeps everything floating and going. Although culture and civilized culture are good things, they have some bad tendencies. A major bad tendency of civilized human culture is to get overly restrictive, narrow, standardized. Develop a strong sense of what is good, acceptable, appropriate, and right. What normal is and what normal should be. Ever hear stories about how straight suburban culture was in the U.S. in the 1950s? Well, this was happening in various ways all over the world, all over the economically developed world. Culture was basically tightening up. Just when modern, civilized, industrialized, developed culture was becoming uncomfortably tight in the middle of the last century, along came this small band of Fluxus folks around the world who used radical art, strange activities, objects, and performances, and upside-down creativity to reverse this narrowing down, restricting tendency in the evolution of human culture. They were huge cultural tricksters who pumped a whole lot of new creative energy into culture by expanding, and in some cases obliterating, what we consider normal, interesting, and meaningful human behavior to be. These guys brought on the 60s, an extremely open, experimental, and challenging period that's helped propel and creatively energize human culture on planet Earth for the last 50 years. At least the parts of culture that you hipsters care about. So Fluxus was this amazing and powerful burst of creativity that helped expand the potential and possibilities in civilized culture, not restrict it. And yet most people, and even most hipsters, have never heard about Fluxus. Or if they have, they think it was just some later repeated version of Dada. You know Dada, the early 20th century art movement of absurdist theater and arguments that industrially manufactured objects like urinals could be art. Although Fluxus does have some of its roots in Dada and Futurism and John Cage, as you'll hear, it was actually a lot subtler, bigger, and more effective than Dada. Dada is pretty blatant about its creativity. Take something to its opposite extreme. You think high art is a nice religious oil painting? Well, I say it's a urinal, and that urinal should be in an art museum too. A shocking, attention-getting argument, but easily dismissed or ignored by most people and culture. Fluxus, by contrast, approached art, performance, and everyday culture and everyday human behavior from 100 different right angles. Not extreme opposites, but very interesting and provocative right angles. Fluxus is more likely to draw you in and give you something to really feel and really think about and change than Dada, Andy Warhol, or Damien Hirst ever dreamed of. And if you don't believe me, well, just take my word for it. And the most wonderful thing about Fluxus is that much of it was done as a gag or a joke. One of the greatest creative forces, one of the greatest creative viruses in human history, came as odd, entertaining little jokes and gags presented as avant-garde art. Don't take my word for it. Let's listen to George Matunas, the central figure and organizer of the earliest Fluxus activities. George is probably the other one of the coolest people you'll never meet, besides me. So let's listen to this master trickster describe some of the origins and influences behind the rise of Fluxus. Avant-garde art wrapped in humor and gags, or humor and gags wrapped in avant-garde art. Take your pick. The audio clip you're about to hear, and the other ones you'll hear today, come from a George Matunas interview recorded in 1977 at a Seattle radio station. The audio quality isn't great, and it's also difficult because George Matunas immigrated to the United States as an adult from Lithuania, so he's got an accent. But please keep in mind that this is one of the central eyewitnesses to the international rise of Fluxus, one of the great creative forces still shaping our culture. So when you hear George Matunas say humorous, think humorous.
Well, George, let's get back a little bit. How did Fluxus get its start?
Well,
Alexandrian school, is that?
Yeah, it's Alexandrian school. Actually, the sort of more obvious start is when the name was first used in 1961, and that was sort of direct influence. It was influenced directly by the school of John Cage that he had in the New School, where people like George Brecht, Dick Higgins, Jackson McLaw were taking, in 1958 to 59, I think, they were taking a class. And all those people later were associated with Fluxus. Then Marcel Duchamp is probably the greatest influence, and he influenced John Cage in turn, who influenced us.
Right.
And then the Dadas, but especially the Taris Dadas. They were doing more events then. In Zurich, they had some events in Cabaret Voltaire, but in Paris, they were doing almost like street events or tours and, you know, more varied kind of events, rather than just a cabaret situation. The events were, there's one very famous one where the audience was, you know, the way audience usually throw tomatoes at performance.
Right.
The performers, when they don't like it, well, here the performers came out with baskets of tomatoes. That was the problem at the audience.
Yeah, right, I think I remember all that one. Yeah.
Well, the futurists have done even before that. They've done things like they would have a whole play. They lift the curtain only like a couple inches, and the whole play would go on behind. You just see the feet. They call it foot theater.
Foot. Yeah.
But that's sort of similar to a piece of Ben Wattier, who has a lot of theater shock pieces, as he calls. And there would be, for instance, a play going on, and all announced, so the people will come for that play, but the door is locked. Meanwhile, the play starts and goes on. And they just, you know, they hear all the noises, but they cannot get in.
Okay, so they're beating on the outside.
Or there is another audience piece like that, similar, where at the end of the concert, we would tell that, well, the last piece has to be performed in a secret place, and we have to take one row at a time to that place. So the usher will take the first row of people, they would follow him, and he would just take them down the back exit into the street, out of the theater. Meanwhile, the rest, you know, they all sort of drinking in anticipation, what's that next piece? And then just one, and they'll never know except when they actually go through it.
Right, so that goes on for an hour.
Yeah. But in 1960, there was a lot of this happening and events going on. And what happened in right after that year, they sort of tended to break into two camps, like the serious and the humorous, and or I would call like neo-baroque and neo-haiku, you know, like okay. Cuvier, one thing at a time, very simple, sort of like a gag. And neo-baroque would be like lots of things going on at the same time, like spectacles of Louis XIV in Versailles.
Right.
So, and meanwhile, like, the humorous things would be, well, like, some of Buster Keaton gags.
Did these groupings take place in...
very informally, yeah, very informally, and they may not even have been aware that, or we may not have been aware that there were those groupings, but what happened is that our first plan was to publish a magazine, Fluxus. And that's how the name came about. And we just plug the dictionary meaning, and there are several meanings, which anybody can look up. But it sort of naturally tended to attract people that were doing those humorous things. And then the name sort of stuck to, well, the magazine never came out in time. It came like 5 or 4 years after we started to plan it. We just found that it was too costly to do. But concerts were easy to do. So, like in 1962, we had a whole series of concerts in Europe because it was especially easy to do them there. I just went like to Wiesbaden, mayor, and told him, "Well, we'd like to do a festival of American music, you know, new American music."
American music at that time.
He figured, okay, he doesn't even know John Cage. So he probably thought, I don't know what.
Benny Goodman.
Yeah, something like that. Oh, he said, yeah. Fine. Yeah. He'll give us like 20, the theater in a museum for 20 concerts.
Yeah.
And then the first concert, and that's when the Flux Fest was used first, or something like it, concert. The first concert, I remember, we obtained a sort of a real junk piano, grand piano that really was of, couldn't even be repaired. So we thought the best way to dispose of it would be to destroy it. And in fact, we like started a whole fad of destroying, you know, like, after 1962, there were every college they were destroying, yeah, but usually like, good piano.
Yeah,
yeah. Anyway, we had this piano, and then we found, we tried to do it very gentle way with screwdrivers. No, it wouldn't work. We just had to, you know, break it up with sledgehammers. Meanwhile, the audience and all the newspapers, they thought we were destroying the museum piano. The called us culture Bolsheviks.
Oh, no.
Now, the mayor was in on vacation somewhere in Switzerland, so they recalled him. He almost lost his job. But they never asked us that where we got the piano. They just assumed it was the museum piano. Completely demolished. But they didn't stop us. I mean, we kept doing those concerts. Then we traveled to Copenhagen, Düsseldorf, Amsterdam, Hague, in Paris, then in Nice, which was sort of the end of the European, first European tour, I think it was 1964, where Ben Wautier was living. In fact, there's a whole group of French artists, like Armand is from Nice too, and so like many of the Nouveau Realists are connected with Nice. So sometimes they call Nice School. But the city itself is very conservative. So that usually we had no problem with obtaining theaters, but in Nice, the theater director chickened out the last minute, and he didn't want to just close it in front of our faces, so he just called like truckfuls of police to surround the whole theater, and no audience, no performers admitted. So then we thought, if we can do it in a theater, we'll do it on the street. So that's how we started to do street performances. And then with his very good state performer. He just loves to do it. And we done dozens of pieces, but there was one piece that really specially fitted Nice. In Nice, they have like the Grand Boulevard, which is right along the seashore, and
right.
On one side they're flanked by very fancy hotels, then the other side has the beach and the sea. And in the evening, like everybody's out on that boulevard, and all the cars just sort of drive back and forward
promenade
to show off.
Yeah.
Yes, like an automobile promenade. So we had like 8 performers all bunched together, very tight, and going in very tiny steps, like half-inch little steps, across the street, you know. And we had all like winter clothing and bowler hats, very formally dressed.
Right.
And all the cars would have to stop and like wait for 10 minutes till we, you know, took all
this way of crossing the,
we would cross the boulevard and then just continue on through the beach, down, down, down into the water. Until that boat had floated away. That was like a straight line.
Oh, beautiful.
But beautiful. I saw recently a cartoon even, like a New Yorker magazine, I think. And that's like I would call it a Flux cartoon. They had a whole busload of executives were brought into the beach, and they all just massed into the sea.
Right.
In the same way.
Oh,
okay, let me stop and point out a couple of things here. Before The Who got famous for destroying guitars and amps on stage, Fluxus was destroying pianos on stage. And in fact, the first pushing of a piano out of a window or off a roof and calling the sound of the crash music was done by Al Hansen, another early Fluxus contributor and influencer. Al Hansen is the grandfather of the musician you hipsters know as Beck. Okay, it's hard to appreciate how radical these Fluxus activities and performances were at the time now. Because of Fluxus, we now live in a world where David Letterman's Stupid Human Tricks, Jackass, and things like that are well within the bounds of civilized entertainment. It wasn't always so. Before going on with more clips from the interview, let's talk about George Mičiūnas for a moment. He was a Lithuanian immigrant living in New York who traveled back and forth to Europe. He earned a living as a graphic designer, a colorblind graphic designer. He hung out in the ultra-hip, post-World War II avant-garde art and hipster scene in New York and was attracted to unconventional artists, hipsters, and rebels. He ran a gallery to feature their work and ideas, and he organized Fluxus as an umbrella for their concerts and performances. He wound up creating a lot of Fluxus work himself. But George Mičiūnas was also an amazingly, genuinely eccentric human. He had the weirdest eating habits I have ever heard of. He had weird hobbies, like collecting a lot of rocks whenever he traveled. Another hobby, collecting and studying shit. Animal feces from a large number of different animals from all over the world. The one time he got married, the official marriage ceremony consisted of him and his bride removing their wedding clothes, swapping them, and then redressing in the other person's clothes. This guy was the real deal, not a poser.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I always, when I travel, I always, you know, the first thing I do is look for pebbles.
I
go. But it's a famous museum or something, I look outside for a famous or famous town. So my suitcase would be like half full of rocks. And at customs, like first time I had to go through customs, they just couldn't believe it. You know, they say everybody brings like, you know, liqueurs and perfumes, and this guy's bringing rocks. They say, hey, you other guys, you know, come and look at this crazy suitcase. They would be heavy too.
Let's listen to George Mičiūnas describe some of the other fun things they did to their audiences. Notice how they turned the whole artist and audience thing in its head. At a Fluxus concert or event, the performers get the audience to do things. The performers are entertained by the audience. Andy Kaufman came along years later and did similar things with his audiences. I don't know if Andy Kaufman even knew about Fluxus, but he's cut from the same wonderfully weird and wildly creative cloth.
It's like Ben Wattier was very active, and he still is. He had a piece, which he has done in Nice, and then we repeated it up here again. What he did in Nice, he took chartered a bus, filled it up with people, and then took them up on a mountain, like a couple of miles from the city. And then when they all got off the bus, he quickly came back with an empty bus. So they had to walk all the way back. It took them like 4 hours. Then we thought, we'll do that in New York. And they had some show where Ben was participating in Guggenheim Museum. So the museum provided us with a bus. And they thought we'll just tour the city or something. So it was midnight. And the fall in November was sort of a drizzly night too. We thought we'll go to the middle of the Bear Mountains, which is, neither of us knew about Bear Mountains. And then we started to drive and on, we saw that was a very big forest. If we leave those people in there, they may be freeze to death or something. So then we sort of had to improvise quickly some solution which wouldn't be so harsh. And we had all the people come out of the bus, and I gave everybody a flashlight. Then we say, now we're going to go up the little hill there to have like a picnic or some games, like 2 o'clock in the morning. And well, okay, they're all following. A little suspicious, but you know, as long as we're around, they figure it's okay, because you know, we're with them. And meanwhile, I told the bus driver to drive like a half a mile to a different spot on the road and wait for us there. Right. Now we went up to the little hill, and I say, well, for the next piece, now I have to collect all the flashlights. So I collected the flashlights and I run off. So now they had to find their way through the dark to the spot where they thought the bus was, but then bus meanwhile had moved. So it took them a couple hours to get the bus.
Did you lose some friends that night?
No, actually, there were no friends in that bus. There were strangers.
Oh, I see.
But probably they would never buy our objects.
No, not.
But we did like sort of like a game. There was a street cleaning event, which was done in front of Plaza Hotel in New York. And then we got permission from Parks Department. And yeah, it was very official. It said we're going to clean one like a square yard of the sidewalk. And the permission said, you know, what tools we're going to use. Then there was even a parks inspector that came to see that we really did the thorough cleaning of that square the way we said we would.
And
so
the tools.
We all dressed up like doctors with white coats and had just miniature tools like toothbrushes, toothpicks, you know, dentist tools, and all kinds of detergents, and then bleach, and then finally with alcohol. It was so white, that square. For a couple of weeks, it just remained like a big white square. Very, very clean.
What was the audience reaction?
Well, they thought we were selling brushes. You know, they said, what is this? What, we're selling brushes or cleaning fluids?
I don't think this is true of Fluxus in general, but George Michunas really seemed to like pranking or irritating an audience more than he seemed to want to entertain them. Here's one last example of this particular attitude from a Fluxus activity at a public dance.
That's how it reminds me of another event where we asked to do just a piece or performance for some benefit concert, which had followed by like a big dance, like ballroom dance, and so we were all dressed up like workers, and we were just hanging. Actually, we were hanging scotch tape on the ceiling like a big net. Now people thought we were just hanging decoration like ribbons, you know, and they always kept saying, "Why are those workers working here when we're dancing? You know, couldn't they have done it before?" We had overalls, and I just said flux worker. Then when we all hung it up, big network of scotch tape, then it was supported at 4 points only. So at one signal, we could cut all those 4 points, and the whole net came down on the dancers with scotch tape. They were completely
entangled.
Yeah, with all sticky stuff. Yeah, man, they were angry, the dancers.
Fluxus was and is a lot more than just creatively radical and unsettling concerts and performances. It was hundreds of people all over the world making wonderfully strange objects, like portable holes and Fluxus medical kits. People creating performance instructions, like draw a line and follow it. People inventing weird new extreme sports, and people messing with existing childhood games, like musical chairs. And people creating weird foods and dinner parties. These Fluxus folks staked out a huge new creative space that we're still all living in.
Also, a recent object of Larry Miller is a fan, for a ceiling fan, which goes as slow as a clock, very slow. Perfect. And then another on a wall, there is a clock that has the fan motor, so it goes as fast as the fan. So you have two useless objects.
You got into sports and games at one point.
Yes.
When was this?
Well, when we started those street events, it sort of led naturally into game-like things. And then next thing, or playing soccer on stilts, or try shot put with roller skates. You know, like it's impossible. Yeah, it goes nowhere. Just a couple of feet from you, because you roll back as you throw. You roll back too.
Right.
So you need a action and this reaction thing has to work so that you're standing still on the ground, or balloon javelins, or you know, we were taking existing sports and like preparing them the way John Cage prepares the piano. So we could call it, you know, prepared sports. We had the obstacle shoe races where the shoes would be prepared. Like, for instance, you take swimmer's flippers and attach, extend them by attaching even like wooden boards, you know, so you're like a giant duck foot.
That's like appropriate.
4 feet long. Yeah, very hard to run with them. Or run on grass with roller skates. Or, like, so you couldn't bend your knees, you insert your leg in a paper tube. So you have to, like, run with stiff legs or with crutches, you know. So everyone will have a different kind of prepared handicap. Yeah, we call that handicap race,
right.
Yeah. Or we would have also handicap races where you would do something while you run. Like, we wanted to do one where people would be drinking a bottle of vodka while running.
A bottle of vodka?
Yeah, so that, you know, they start getting very tipsy as they come to the end. But then we were warned that you could get like a heart attack while you drank and ran at the same time. So we didn't do that.
Early Fluxus stuff is quite expensive and collectible today, and resides in many public and private art collections around the world. It's now taken seriously. But take heart, you unappreciated hipsters. If Fluxus survived being ignored and unappreciated by serious culture, maybe you can too. Maybe you can enjoy entertaining children and amusing adults. George Michuna survived on the humor of it all.
Usually, kids like our thing, or just people that don't expect art.
Right.
You know, we had once a store on Canal Street where we didn't sell a single thing to art collectors. Actually, we didn't sell them at all, but people would come off the street like they were digging a hole in the street or something, so the workers would come, and yeah, you know, they had a lot of fun.
You never sold a thing.
No, because, you know, to the workers, who needs a $5 gag? It's expensive, but for the collector, it's too cheap.
It's too cheap. And how long was the store open?
Oh, like almost a couple of years.
Two years.
Yeah, still not one thing.
That's pretty humorous in itself.
Yeah, that's a funny event.
Okay, we're done. That's your introduction to Fluxus. Go forth and multiply. Or go to fluxus.org on the internet and learn more. George Michunas died in 1978 at the age of 46, less than a year after this interview with William Woods. His laugh and Fluxus live on, and the world is a much more interesting and creative place for it.